Morning. So yesterday we discussed basically really the foundations of thermodynamics and statistical physics, how the notions as entropy, temperature, internal energy actually are introduced. And so in thermodynamics it's very simple. Basically for each of these notions you have one thermodynamic law, and you know, given this thermodynamic law you can define the corresponding quantity, and once you have these quantities you can actually calculate something. So really if you are interested in how the pressure and volume of the gas changes, it's useful, temperature is a useful concept to do that, and similarly internal energy is a useful concept for calculations and so on. So now what I would like to do today is I would basically like to review, hopefully, basics of statistical physics. Basics. And maybe I'll do it slightly non-traditionally. I'll start from the fact that our world is inherently quantum. And then, so I'll start from quantum theory, and then use this, you know, quantum results to go to a classical theory. So, part one, let's do quantum versus classical. And so, let me start with the quantum. So, quantum system. So you know that your stage for quantum theory is the Hilbert space. So stage here where everything happens is the Hilbert space. And if you want to describe some pure, well, okay, so the microscopic state, is described by a vector in this Hilbert space. And so this is a pure state. And so psi belongs to this Hilbert space H. Okay. So now Aggie told me that you know everything about density matrix and everything about quantum more generally. So then you know that if you want to describe something which has some kind of probability in it, then you use the density matrix. And this precisely corresponds to a microstate and basically a statistical ensemble of things in quantum world. So if you want to describe a microstate, then you don't really know, you know, which pure state takes place, but rather you are given a probability that maybe it is that state or maybe that is that state. So microstate is described by the density matrix. So I will omit hats above the operators. Let's just call it density matrix rho. I hope it's the same thing. Sometimes people use D. And so what this density matrix rho describes is, well, it is given by a sum over all possible states, well, lambda or possible configurations, and then you have the basis. And P lambda is the probability that this thing happens. So this is the probability. Okay. And so this density matrix has a number of properties. So for example, you want that the probability is non-negative. It's a real number which is positive. Which imposes some restrictions, like rho is equal to rho dagger or something like that. For us, very important property is that you can normalize this density matrix, and you can always do that trace rho is equal to 1. And then
I don't know if you have seen, but basically a generalization of the Schrödinger's equation is called von Neumann equation. Which basically describes how this density matrix evolves in time. And so d rho over dt, and we are in quantum, so we have to have h bar somewhere. So let's put it here, I h bar. And it's given by a commutator of the Hamiltonian with the density matrix. And everybody's seen this equation before? Ah, perfect. So Egi was right. You know everything about quantum. So the simple way to verify this is really you take a pure state. You take a density matrix which corresponds to the pure state. So let's say rho is psi psi. And then you know that pure state satisfies Schrödinger's equation. And so you can then calculate what d rho over dt is. And you will verify that in that special case, this equation is true. And it's a simple exercise to do. But of course, if you know more general proof, that's even better. OK. So now, of course, the observables. In quantum theory, are simply described by operators. So we have operators and so, for example, given, and so now we are interested in what is basically the average value of this operator given the density matrix rho. So that's called expectation value. And then you can calculate the expectation value. So for example, if I have an operator A, then the expectation value, let's call it small a, and this is given by trace of the density matrix times that operator. Okay, so this is how you calculate, you know, what basically an average, what happens if you are in that given microscopic state, and you want, you know, let's say you want to measure energy. So the average energy is given by the expectation value of the Hamiltonian. So we'll have trace rho h here. Okay, so this is all we need to know about quantum systems. But of course, in statistical physics, you don't usually need to deal with quantum systems. And you can actually use classical description. And so let me just do this very brief estimate, you know, when you can use classical physics. So classical physics approximation, physics approximation. And let me do just this very, very crude estimate, is that you may estimate the effect of fluctuations so you have thermal fluctuations, and so you compare the kinetic energy these fluctuations can give, which is just delta P square over 2m. And so these are excited by temperature, so you basically get a very crude estimate for these thermal fluctuations given by KBT. On the left-hand side, we have energy. On the right-hand side, we have energy, so it must be correct. Okay. So now you may also estimate a mean distance between molecules, so distance. So for example, if you consider a gas, okay, and so you assume that you have a gas of volume V, so then, okay, so I'll just write it down. So if you have gas of volume V, then the volume per particle is V over N, where N is the number of particles. And then you approximately take 1 over 3 that has dimensions of length. And so this is average distance between the molecules. So now Heisenberg principle tells you that delta x, delta p is something like h bar. Of course, if the left-hand side is much bigger than h bar, then you can neglect quantum effects. So what we require is that delta x, delta p is much bigger than h bar. And then we have classical physics basically valid. OK? So now if you plug it in, again, very complicated mass. So delta p is something like 2m kbt square root of that. And delta x is that thing over here. So v over m 1 over 3. And you require that this is much bigger than h bar. And so now very complicated manipulation. But what you find out that this is exactly equivalent to the fact that kbt is n over v to 2 over 3 h square over 2m. So this is your condition for classical physics. So now this condition, so this n over v is particles density. So it's how many particles per volume you have, so particles density. And so you are getting a condition for your classical physics to be valid that either the temperatures are really, really big or the particle densities are very, very small. So if you have, so if you have dense gases, you may question applicability of classical physics here, of classical approximation. But yeah, if you have low densities, high temperatures, classical physics almost always valid. Okay.
Do you remember the numbers for, say, electrons and
atoms? I don't remember any numbers. But for example, in neutron stars, you have density so high that you cannot use classical physics. It will give you the wrong answer. I don't know. Do you remember? Thank you.
This looks like the thermodynamical limit.
Sorry?
This looks like the thermodynamical limit.
Thermodynamic limit is something else. Basically, you are taking infinite size of the system. So you are taking n goes to infinity, v goes to infinity, and stuff like that, preserving particle density. So that's what a thermodynamic limit is. You are taking the system to be really, really big. And we will discuss it later. Okay. So now we have a condition when we can apply classical physics. And so let's assume that this condition is satisfied. So then we have classical physics description. So now the stage, so let me compare to what we were doing over there. So now our stage, of course, is nothing else than the phase space. And so if we have n particles, so in each particle is characterized by three positions and three momenta, so by six variables. So phase space has let's call it sigma n for n particles. And it's basically R to the 6n dimensional space. And so it composes of Q1, P1, and Qm, and Pn. Okay. So these are things. So now every microstate corresponds to a dot in this phase space. So if really I have one particular configuration, I just have one point in my phase space. And of course, the evolution of this point, time evolution of this point, is described by Hamilton's equations. Okay, so by classical mechanics. So microscale is a point in sigma n, and its trajectory, time evolution, corresponds to Hamilton's equations. Of course, this would be crazy to do in practice because you have n is very, very large. So you have very many Hamilton's equations, and you would need to solve them, and it's not very practical to do that. However, you don't have to do it because you can actually just deal with a microstate. Not microstate, but macrostate. And so that is described by a probability distribution in the phase space. So now you see that we are exactly going parallel with what happens in the quantum system. We know what a microstate is, we know what a macrostate is. And so, of course, the probability distribution W will correspond to the density matrix there. So it somehow knows, you know, this microstate happens with that probability, that microstate happens with that probability, and so on. So now, if you are interested in that probability, you just take that density distribution, probability distribution W, of course, that depends on all these particles, P1, Qn, and Pn. It can also depend on time, in the same way as the density matrix can depend on time. And then, of course, you have to multiply this by the volume of the phase space where this is done. So basically, this tells you a weight, how you take the corresponding weight in the phase space. Is it really occupied? Is it not occupied? And this is just a volume element on the phase space.
Is that time?
Tau. Sorry. So now this d tau n for n particles has very funny prefactor. So you would think d tau n is just d3q1, d3p1, d3q2, d3p2, and so on. But there's some funny factor which you have to include. And this funny factor comes out to be, so first of all, if you have n particles, there's n factorial in the denominator. And then there's 2 pi h bar to power 3n. And then what you would expect, so d3p1, d3q1, and d3pn, d3qn. Okay, so this is your volume element on your phase space. And so this is the probability you'll find that configuration in the phase space. So now this funny prefactor 2 pi h bar comes from the fact that basically it doesn't make sense to consider regions in the phase space which are smaller than h bar. So you cannot squeeze states. So this thing comes from comparison to quantum mechanics. And basically what you require is that the integral of W is equal to 1, similarly to trace of rho is equal to 1. So you can find this normalization by requiring that. But this 2 pi h bar really comes from the fact that I cannot squeeze anything in the region smaller than h bar in the phase space. Okay? That's a good point. Good point, yeah. Well, yeah. Well, you can put that, yeah. Yeah. So with this definition, then, you have exactly the same property as that trace rho equals to 1, which means that integral of v d tau n equals to 1. So really, the probability that you find some microstate is equal to 1. Well, which is fine. Okay, so finally, what we could do is that we could find an average of some value there, and it was a trace of row A. So now, of course, the direct generalization of that, if you are using W instead of row, is just so if you have observable. So now this observable, of course, is a function. On your phase space, so it's a function of Q's and P's and possibly T. And so if you're interested in the average value of this observable, then it's given by the integral A, P, Q, and T, and then W, P, Q, and T, and D tau n. Okay, precisely as over there. So basically what you find is that the trace is something like an integral, and if you understand that trace is something like an integral, you can directly transfer one to another. Okay, so you just replace row with W and every trace with an integral, and that's it. And I give you the table in the study text how really, but basically I went through all the steps. Questions? Okay, so now we have a classical statistical physics, basically. And so the statistical ensemble is described by this density distribution W. Okay, so now let me mention some very important theorem which we did in classical mechanics, which is called Liouville's theorem. So part two. And I told you in classical mechanics that it has some, you know, far-reaching consequences for the statistical physics description. So let's see what these consequences are. But you will not go that way. You will rather than switch to something quantum mechanical later on, and do, you know, do go around this way. But yeah, you could do it through Liouville's theorem if you want. So what happens? So now we want to go from the quantum mechanical description to a classical description. And we want to find what is a classical analog of that von Neumann equation over there. So we want to know how the density distribution evolves in time. And of course, for that, you use just the correspondence between classical and quantum mechanics. So you know that if you have QP equals to 1, then this translates into 1 over h bar Q and P hats, now let me put, equals to 1. Okay, so this is the correspondence between classical physics and quantum physics. Or more generally, if you have, let me go the other way around now, FG, so now you have commutators, then you can replace them by I h bar and the Poisson brackets of F and G of the corresponding classical quantities here. Okay, so usually people studying quantum mechanics, they go from this way to that way, but of course that's an incorrect way because you can only guess what the true quantum system is from classical physics. Well, you can make some guesses, but it may not be true. The true way is that you go from quantum to classical. So the quantum description is the right one, and then you go to a classical one, which follows from there. Okay. So anyway, so let me use this one. And so we start from that von Neumann equation. So now in this transcription, of course, the density matrix becomes my probability distribution W. So just by doing this correspondence, so from here, I have dV dW over dt, and then equals to, and if I'm using this thing, so I replace the commutator with I h bar and the Poisson brackets here. And so I'm getting h and b, but now these are the Poisson brackets. Okay. So now I can put everything on the left-hand side, and I notice that this is nothing else than what we call the total derivative in the classical mechanics. So this is equivalent to saying that dv over dt, which is now Poisson bracket VH plus TV over DT is equal to zero. Okay, so what I have done is that I have swapped the order of W and H. You pick up a minus sign because Poisson brackets are antisymmetric, and so you have this equation here. Okay, so this is called Liouville's equation. So it's a classical analog of the von Neumann equation, which is valid for the density matrix. So now for our probability distribution, you have the Liouville's equation here. Okay, so now the question is, so this must be satisfied by any density probability distribution, any density distribution in our phase space. So how to solve this equation? So of course the simplest solution, so how to solve, so solution of this. So first solution is you just take W equals to constant. Okay, if you take W equals to constant, then obviously W doesn't depend on time explicitly, so this is zero, and constant commutes with the Hamiltonian. So this is definitely a solution. And this solution corresponds to a microcanonical ensemble. So you basically found what this W is, and you are saying, well, you know, each state is basically equally probable. So this W gives you a probability, and so each state is equally probable. And that's what microcanonical ensemble actually describes. So now this seems very conceptually simple and very nice, but the problem is that the microcanonical ensemble is very difficult to deal with from a computational point of view. Because what happens is that all your motions are always on a constant energy hypersurface. And so now you are fixing this constant energy hypersurface, which means that you have to impose everywhere, no matter which integral you calculate, no matter which average you calculate, that the energy is exactly, you know, that equal to that energy which the system has. And so that introduces delta functions in your calculations, and these delta functions are not the most easy to deal with. So nobody basically uses the microcanonical ensemble. Okay, so anyway, this was one possibility. So now the other possibility is that you know that dw over dt, the total derivative, equals to zero. Okay, so the second solution, of course, is that what it's telling you is that w is a constant of motion. It doesn't depend. So it doesn't evolve in time. It's a constant of motion in some sense. So W must be a function of constants of motion for the system. Okay, so more generally, so now, of course, if you take generic system, this will have only few integrals of motion, only few constants of motion. And these will be the total energy in the system is conserved, the total angular momentum of the system is conserved, and the total momentum is conserved. So in general, there's only these seven conserved quantities for the whole system. And so this W, in principle, can be function of all of them, energy, momentum, and angular momentum of the system. Okay, and so then dw over dt will be equal to zero, because all these are actually dE over dt is equal to zero and everything is, yeah. So this is interesting, but you can even simplify it further, because you can always go to a commoving system. So if you are interested in thermodynamics or statistical physics of a system, you are not interested in the motion of the system as a whole. Rather, you want to always go to a system which is commoving with the system and describe your thermodynamics in that system. So you can always set this one equal to zero. So this one is not there. And similarly, You can actually always corrotate with the system unless you want to really describe thermodynamics of rotating systems or something like that. So you can also get rid of that one. So now you have a very, very simple relation that W has to be a function of energy only. Okay, very good. Well, this is very nice because energy is additive. So if you consider two systems, system one and system two, then of course the corresponding density probability is a product of the two. So it's W1 times W2. So now you may think, well, let's take a logarithm of this. Logarithms V1, 2 is,
How do you add the systems?
How do you add the systems?
What are the elements of the complex system?
Oh, so you consider, so you take a product of two systems, right? So I have one system, I have another system. Of course, now I put them together.
We have elements in one system and elements in one system. Elements of the composite system are elements of either one or one system or the pairs.
The pairs, of course.
The pairs.
So you take a product of the phase spaces. So then you have, of course, it's a product of. Okay, so I'm just, doing a heuristic analysis here. I'm not really doing anything exact. I'm just, trying to find what this W of E might look like. Okay, let's say in a simple case. So I'm saying if you have two systems, this must be true. And then you may have a great idea, take a logarithm, and then this is true. But of course, if you have two systems, then the total energy of these two systems is a sum of energy of first one and sum of the energy of the second one if they are interacting only weakly. Okay, so this is equal to E1. Well, this is E. Well, you can say that something which actually adds like that is the energy. So
can you reiterate that you just apply the first one and the product?
W12 is just a product. Yeah, it's just what I mean by taking the product of two systems.
Yeah.
And I take it W1 times W2. Okay, and so the energies at. So we have E is E1 plus E2. Of course, this suggests that this logarithm of W actually is something like energy. Okay, so from here, you can sort of argue that logarithm of W is, let's say, constant plus another constant times energy. Or you can, of course, integrate this, and you have that W is E to the alpha plus beta E. Okay, so this is just a heuristic argument. I'll do it much more exactly now, so don't worry. If you don't like this argument, it's fine. But I'm just trying to show you that really from Liouville's theorem, which comes from Neumann's equation, you can already know what this W, what this density distribution is. Of course, the corresponding density distribution corresponds to canonical ensemble, where your energy can fluctuate. Okay, so that's another possibility, which is now a much better choice because calculating canonical ensemble is very simple, contrary to microcanonical ensemble. If this were true, I take this alpha, I put it there because I want to normalize this W in some way, and that allows me it here. But you're right, from here probably alpha would have to be zero. So you can say W is normalized and then alpha is zero, or it's not normalized and I have to put alpha there. Okay, So this is a canonical ensemble, and that's another possibility. So now what you see here is that everything is in some sense a consequence of the fact of that point Neumann equation, which tells you nothing else than actually the time evolution, that the quantum theory is unitary theory. So everything comes, you know, to a unitarity of quantum theory, and then you have this beautiful description of statistical systems from there. Okay. So let me not go any further in this direction. Of course, this is still not the Liouville's theorem as I stated it in classical mechanics course, where I said, well, you have the cat. As you evolve in time, the cat gets deformed and stuff like that. So yes, this is the same thing as I'm doing here. And you can read the paragraph in the study text if you want to see that this is indeed the case. But it's the same theorem as the deformation of the cat. Under the time evolution. And that, of course, follows again from Neumann equation. So the cat is, you know, only deformed because of unitarity of quantum mechanics.
Can we also go the other way around, saying that the Liouville's equation or theorem implies the von Neumann equation?
Well, that's how it was historically done, yes. But of course, it's not the correct way, because you cannot derive quantum theory from a classical one. Yeah, so you can only guess what it might be, but you cannot derive. Yeah.
Isn't there like a more general framework using Poisson brackets, and then just the axiomatic approach, and then you can say now there are two options: either my P and my Q commute or they don't. If they commute, I call that one. Like I say that their commutator is one, and then you get quantum mechanics.
Yeah, well, yeah, people play with these things, with various brackets, and they are trying to, yeah. It's a very useful way how to guess the right theory, but it's not really a derivation, right? So imposing some properties on the brackets, and then, yeah. Yeah, this is what we are doing, for example, when Feynman was constructing Maxwell's theory, he relaxed some of the Poisson brackets and he got some new theory out of it, right? So yeah, people do these things.
And can you perfectly derive classical mechanics from quantum mechanics?
That's what we did here. Yeah, I think so. Yeah, so taking a classical limit of quantum theory should be okay. The other way around, it's not okay, although it's the way it's usually presented. Okay, so now let me do the proper way to do this. So this was just a hint that, you know, we might be getting something like exponential to beta h, where h is beta e, where e is your energy. But let's do it from the scratch and from a different point of view, starting with this quantum mechanical description. So part three. Gibbs distribution. And so I'll do this nice derivation starting from defining statistical entropy. So statistical. So now this falls from the sky, and of course you would have to justify it by comparison to thermodynamics. Statistical or for Neumann entropy and you have seen that probably in your quantum theory course as well. So given the density matrix rho in the quantum mechanical description, I define a quantity which I call S, and it's minus K Boltzmann and trace of rho logarithm of rho. Okay, so given the density matrix, I calculate this quantity. And of course, it's later on, and you have to compare with thermodynamics to show that this is really has something to do with the entropy as I defined it yesterday. Okay, so let's. This is our definition. So from now on, hopefully, consistently, definitely not, I'll set k be equal to 1. K will definitely emerge later on, but it should be equal to 1 in the rest of the course. So let's see if we can do it. Okay. So now there is this. So we have the entropy. And We also have, if we are measuring our system, we impose some conditions on that system. We impose that, for example, that the average energy is U and it's fixed for the system. So we are imposing conditions like trace of rho must be equal to 1. So that's the condition which we always have to have. But there's another condition, is that if we have some observables, then the average value AI is something what we want to prescribe for the system. It has to be. Okay, so these are the conditions. These are the conditions. Okay, so then everything is given by this principle of maximal mass. So principle And so it states that the density matrix rho that represents the equilibrium state of the microsystem is such that it maximizes the statistical entropy, so maximizes S, subject to all these constraints which we have. Subject to constraints. Okay, so that's the most important principle in statistical physics. And it basically tells you, well, provided I'm consistent with all the conditions I require on the system, I always want to make the biggest mass possible. So meaning maximize the statistical entropy. So that's okay. So of course this is in some sense an action principle or principle which is very similar to classical mechanics. You want to extremize the action, so now you want to extremize or maximize the statistical entropy. And so this gives you basically a variational principle for finding what the corresponding density matrix has to be, so that this is true. Okay, questions? So let's do the calculation and find what this density matrix is. Most important calculation in statistical physics, and it's not that difficult. So what it means is that you have to extremize the action, which is basically the statistical entropy. But of course, because you have constraints now, you have to modify your action by putting these Lagrange multipliers and constraints, as we have done in in classical mechanics. So the action which you have to really, so we have to maximize a functional, or the following functional, p functional, I, which is now the entropy, but now I have to add or subtract, doesn't matter, sum of Lagrange multiplier times the constraint, Lagrange multiplier times the constraint, and so on. So if we have n constraints, then we sum over all of them, and the constraint is trace row ai minus ai, and this is the Lagrange multiplier. And then I also have the constraint that the matrix is normalized, and so this is my action I have to maximize. Okay. Well, let's do it. So we want to extremize this, and we are finding, so we are basically finding an equation of motion for rho, or solution for rho. So the only thing which actually varies in this thing is rho. So all the other things are fixed. So anyway, so what delta I is delta S, and then minus sum over I, lambda I, and then I have trace of AI delta rho. Of course, this guy is a constant, so that's zero, minus lambda zero trace of delta rho. So almost done. So now this is a little bit more problematic. I have to differentiate a logarithm, which is of course very complicated. So now I have S is minus trace rho log rho. So it gives me two terms. So it's minus trace delta rho log rho. That's the first term. And the other term is that I differentiate the logarithm. So it's minus trace rho, and then t of logarithm is 1 over rho and delta rho. So it's minus trace of delta rho. Everybody happy so far? Okay, so it's all thing here. Okay, so now you can put it in a form where you collect all the terms and just put delta rho outside of that. So this can be written as, okay, so let's put minus here and then trace. And so first I will have logarithm of rho, and then I will have minus one, plus one, and then from here I will have lambda I ai, and there's a sum. And from here I have plus lambda zero. Okay. And then delta rho. Hopefully it's correct, is it? Maybe. Okay. So now this thing here is some matrix B. So you have that three trace of B times delta rho. And so this must be maximized. Of course, the action is equal, well, delta must be equal to zero. So this, by the action principle, has to be true. Okay. So now, what do you think this implies? Well, exactly. So B has to be zero by this action principle. It's not so trivial to see, because delta rho is not any matrix. If delta rho were any matrix, then if you have trace B times, let's say, any matrix A, and it has to be zero for any matrix A, then B has to be zero. But rho is actually Hermitian, so it's slightly restrictive on the form of the matrices, but you can still show that this is true. Okay, so B has to be equal to zero. So in other words, logarithm of rho, and so now what is this equal to? It's equal to minus, and then it's 1 plus lambda 0 times a unit matrix and minus some lambda I AI. Or you can take the exponential of this, e to the rho is e to minus 1 plus lambda 0, and then e to minus lambda I ai. I can of course split the exponentials, because unit matrix commutes this any. Is it? Is it correct now? Okay. Very good. So this is our solution from the density matrix. But we still have these conditions which we need to impose, and sort of, you know, I could have done that earlier, but I can still impose this equation trace of rho is equal to 1. So now if you trace this, then you have trace of rho equals to 1, and it's this thing times trace of this thing here. So we have a condition from here, trace of rho equals to 1 equals to e minus 1 plus lambda 0, and then trace of e to minus some lambda ii. In other words, this thing here is just 1 over trace, 1 over that. Okay, very good. So because we have this 1 over that, it's good to introduce a new quantity, and let's call it z, and it will be the partition function. Okay, so imposing that condition and making the following definition, so define z to be trace of e to minus sum over lambda I AI. Let's call this quantity a partition function. Okay, so this is just a definition. And so if we do that, then we just see that this e to minus 1 plus lambda 0 is just 1 over z. Okay, so we know that, so then rho is just 1 over z, and e to minus sum lambda I ai. And this is the most general density matrix you can ever have, and it's called Gibbs distribution. Okay, we have done this, the most important derivation in statistical physics. So every density matrix which is consistent with these conditions has to look like this thing here. Okay, questions?
Why are we not picking the other
constraints? Oh, you can. We will. Yeah, we will, of course. Yeah. Okay, so this is really the most important thing and the nicest thing. So now you can use these things to show, let's say, three almost immediate properties of what, which follow from here. So first of all, the first statement is the average value of these things, or the expectation values, are just given by the derivatives with respect to these Lagrange multipliers of the logarithm of z. Okay, so that's one property which is very important. Second property, that the entropy is just sum lambda I AI plus logarithm of z. So you see that logarithm of z appears very often, and it's an important quantity, as we shall see. And then these Lagrange multipliers are also given by ds over d AI. Okay, so these are the important properties which follow immediately from this here. So maybe let me show the first one, and then you can do it yourself, the other two. Okay, so let's look at what t over, and I'm missing a minus, there's a minus sign. So let's look at what minus t over t lambda I of logarithm of z is. Okay, so I'm differentiating the logarithm, is 1 over z, t of z. So this is minus 1 over z, dz over d lambda I. Okay, so far, no problem. So now I leave that 1 over z is the minus sign. And so I look at my definition of z. And definition of z is this trace of e to something. So now if I differentiate with lambda I just bring ai to the bottom. So this is equal to trace of e to minus lambda I ai. There's still some. And then ai is here. Okay. So now z is just a number. And I can pull it through. And there's a minus sign as well, right? So that now it becomes plus. So now z is just a number. So I can pull it through the trace and put it here, right? So then you have, this is equal to trace of 1 over z, e to minus sum lambda I ai, and then ai. Okay, but of course, this guy here is our density matrix, right? So now we have trace of rho ai, which is, by our constraints, ai. So now I'm imposing the other constraints. So this property comes from here immediately. And you can show the other two by yourself, or you can read the text if you want to. Okay. Questions? Exactly. I'll just give an example now. Yeah, very good. You're absolutely correct. So let us give us an example. So this is the motional Gibbs distribution consistent with all these conditions. But usually, you don't want many conditions to impose on your system. And so the simplest one is that you just say the average value of the energy is equal to that. Okay, and the corresponding thing is canonical ensemble. So part 4, canonical ensemble. Which is a special case where energy is allowed to fluctuate. Well, basically, all the other things are fixed. So number of particles is fixed and so on. So what it means is that you just have an average value of the Hamiltonian and you call it U. And of course, this is trace of rho h. Okay, so that's the only constraint you have now. So now this is my ai, and this is my observable, which is the Hamiltonian energy. Okay, so then if you have only that condition, everything simplifies drastically. So you have that your density matrix in the exponential has only one term. So rho is 1 over z from that formula, and that minus, OK, so now I have only one lambda, and ai is just the Hamiltonian. And so lambda h It's usually not called lambda h, but it's usually called beta. So let's call it beta. So instead of lambda, I'm now cheating on you, I'm just using beta. So this is lambda h and h. And so this is the density matrix. And z is just trace of that, trace e minus beta h. And so this is the total, complete description, if you want, of a canonical ensemble. Okay, so far, it has nothing to do with thermodynamics, right? So, we introduce some stupid statistical entropy. It has nothing to do with thermodynamic entropy. We introduce some density matrix, and then we have these Lagrange multipliers, lambda I there, or this beta here. And this has nothing to do with temperature so far. So we have to make the connection now with thermodynamics to make sense of this thing here. And so let me start with the first law. So how do we recover the first law? Of course, by correct definition. So now you do a definition. So you say that you define work and you define heat. So work delta W. And you define this to be a trace of rho delta H. Okay, so this is the work done. Then you define the heat. We are making the connection with thermodynamics now. So you define the heat delta Q to be trace of delta rho and H. Okay. So these are the definitions. Okay, so then, surprise, surprise, I may calculate what du is. Okay, so u is given here. So du is d of trace of rho h. Okay, I have two terms using the Leibniz rule. So this is trace of, and instead of d, let me write this delta, rho delta h plus trace of h delta rho. Okay, so now this guy is by definition delta work. This guy is by definition delta q. I recovered the first law by this definition. So that's the first law. Let me just remind you again from yesterday that whereas what stands on the left-hand side of this is really a function of state, u is a function of state. So if I have two points going from A to B, that u here, ua, is well-defined, and ub is well-defined, no matter which path I take from A to B. So u is a total, du is a total differential. Whereas what stands on the right-hand side from yesterday, none of these is a total differential. So for example, if I take this path here, I take delta q1 and delta w1. And if I take that path there, it's delta q2, delta w2. And they don't have to be correlated anyhow, apart from the fact that delta q2 plus delta w2 is equal to du. But for example, I can take paths where this guy is zero and I just do work or something like that. So these guys are not total differentials and only their sum is. Okay? So now you may wonder why we define work in this way and heat in that way. And I try to give some very hand-wavy arguments in the study text why this is the case. But basically you can show that if you diagonalize, if you write h and rho in some basis, then this delta v, delta w, looks like something like, sum over m, and then you have the energy levels, and then this is not correct. It's the delta of energy levels and the probabilities. And this guy is something like sum over m and the other way around. So it's delta of probabilities and the energy levels. Okay, so if I expand my Hamiltonian in a basis EM, and then I have the basis of states, then you can show that this delta W, what it does is actually it changes just the value of these energy levels, but the probabilities remain the same. Okay, so this is easily done by, let's say, electric field. If you switch on the electric field, then the energy levels get shifted, but the probabilities of occupations of each energy level actually remains the same. So this can be done by nice conservative work terms. And so that's why you call the corresponding thing a work term. Whereas here, you are doing something much more dirty. You are keeping the energy levels the same, but you are changing the probabilities how the things are occupied. And that's something which you might intuitively understand as heat. You are just, you know, kicking one particle from one energy level to another energy level and so on. Something very, very dirty is happening. So that's why you call the other one heat. But of course, this is only, you know, heuristic, hand-waving argument. What really is important is that you define work like that, you define heat like that, and then you have the first law. Okay, so we have the first law. So it would be nice if we have also the other laws, in particular the second one. Well, the zeros one is boring, so let's not discuss that, but let's do the second one. So second law. So of course, our statistical physics description has to give us the second law, provided you identify something with something. And for that, let us calculate what is the variation of the entropy. So by definition of the statistical entropy, it's just minus delta of trace of rho log rho. This is how we define our entropy. So again, we have two terms. This is minus trace delta rho log rho, and then the other term is minus trace of delta rho. Okay, so this is what it is. So now let's apply this other condition that trace of rho is equal to 1. If trace of rho is equal to 1, if I take a variation of that, then trace of delta rho must be equal to 0. I am differentiating 1, so this must be equal. So this is equal to 0 by the condition that trace of rho equals to 1. Okay. So I have, this is minus trace, and then delta rho. Okay, it's a big thing. So now I need to use what logarithm of rho is. But my rho is over here. So logarithm of rho, logarithm of 1 over z e to minus beta h. Okay, so this is what it is. I'm just plugging that thing here. Of course, logarithm has two terms. So it's, first of all, if it acts on the exponential, it just gives me minus beta h. And if it, minus beta h. And if it acts on 1 over z, it just gives me minus logarithm of z. Okay, so I continue my equation. This is equal to minus trace, and I have, okay, so it's a minus minus, so it's plus. And then I have trace of delta rho, and then beta h. And then the other term is plus trace of delta rho logarithm of z. Okay, so these are the two terms I'm getting. Okay, so now logarithm of z, of course, is a number, so you can take it out. And so you have, again, the same trick. You have a trace of delta rho, which must be equal to 0, right? Because trace of row is 1. So this guy goes to 0. Beta is a number, so I can take it out. So this is beta times trace of delta rho times h. Okay, so now I look at my definitions, and I see that delta rho times h and trace of that is precisely what you call heat over there. Okay, so this is equal to beta times delta q. Mm-hmm. Very good. So now, of course, you would like this to be the most fundamental thing in thermodynamics, which is the Clausius relation. So compare this to whatever we saw yesterday, Clausius relation. Of course, now we have to say, well, the heat is reversible, but why not? So Clausius relation tells us that delta S is delta Q over T, where T is the thermodynamic temperature. And so if these two relations are to be consistent, really S, the statistical entropy, to be called the entropy, then I have to identify that my Lagrange multiplier beta is 1 over T. Okay, so now you are giving a physical meaning to your Lagrange multipliers if you are just, some functions, but now they have physical meaning. It's a temperature, a physical meaning of temperature. Okay, so now you have complete description of canonical ensemble with now, a complete correspondence to thermodynamics. So your density matrix of the canonical ensemble is given as 1 over Z e to minus beta H, where Z is given there, and beta is 1 over thermodynamic temperature of the system. Okay, so we basically done. So final thing I wanted to mention is that, so you have the density matrix and you have the partition function.
So which one are we assuming that S, that my physical entropy, I need to define it with my thermodynamical entropy?
Fair enough. So I've skipped lots of steps. So it seems like I'm defining two quantities by one equation. I'm saying that really S is my thermodynamic entropy, and then in order to get that, I'm also identifying 1 over T. That's absolutely correct. I think this can be done more rigorously, that you first sort of say really S has to be the thermodynamic entropy separately, and then you can identify this guy here. And it can be done, but I just don't want to. Yeah, it can be done. It's a long thing. Well, physically, you can identify two properties at the same time. It's okay. Mathematically not, but physically it's okay. Okay, so final thing. Was there another question?
Taking a canonical ensemble. Is that an assumption that we are making?
It's just a specific example of that thing over here, right? So
are we driving the first and second law based on a specific system?
So what you can show, and I will not show it, is that no matter which ensemble you take, you will, in the thermodynamic limit, you recover the same classical physics. So you recover thermodynamics. So no matter which ensemble I will take, with varying number of particles, with varying pressure, with all these other things, it doesn't matter. So I can use the simplest one possible, which is the canonical one, where only the energy fluctuates.
By different ensembles, you mean different solutions of the Lewis equation?
I mean, if you want, or I can take, all these things here. So I can take A, just one A, which is the Hamiltonian, which is the simplest thing, and it's over there. Or I can take two things, let's say Hamiltonian and the number of particles, or I can take Hamiltonian number of particles and average pressure or something like that. And you can start putting all these things here. So the canonical ensemble is, in some sense, the simplest possible choice. But if you want, if you are interested in thermodynamic limit, then they all give the same thing, which I'm not going to show, but almost true.
But the first and second law are almost all
Well, we did them for thermodynamic systems. So now I'm trying to do just, you know, recover the thermodynamics, which of course is true in the classical limit, if you want. You can extend validity of thermodynamics, for example, to black holes, but yeah, it's another story. So to complete this analogy, you define free energy. And so really, once you know what the partition function is, if you can find what it is, then you define free energy as minus T logarithm of Z. So we have seen that the logarithm of Z appeared in many places over there. So logarithm of Z is important. And so T times logarithm of Z is even more important. It's called free energy. Okay, so now we can use this relation here. So S is equal to, so now lambda is beta AI is just the average energy, which is U, and then plus logarithm of Z. Okay, so that's what the equation gives us. So now I can multiply by something, well, divide by beta. So if you divide by beta, you are getting S over beta, which is ST. It's equal to U. And then you have plus 1 over beta logarithm of Z. 1 over beta is T. So this thing is minus F. In other words, F, so F is U minus TS. Okay? So now you can search your table for thermodynamic potentials, and you will find that the thermodynamic potential is related to the internal energy by subtracting minus TS. It's really the free energy, as you know it from thermodynamics. So really, the quantity which you define by minus T logarithm of Z is very important quantity. And it will satisfy, and you can verify that, but it will satisfy what you expect from the free energy. So in particular, you will find that dF is minus SdT, and then minus PdV, and then plus if you have variable number of particles, which we don't, but anyway, you would have an expression like this from thermodynamics. Okay, so once we identify F, we can actually calculate all the thermodynamic properties of our substance by using just the standard thermodynamics. Particular S is just dF over dT, pressure is dF over dV, number of chemical potential is dF over dN, and so on, right? So really, you can match everything to thermodynamics and calculate everything if you want. So the key thing is to know what the partition function is, because that gives you that free energy there. And so we will calculate some partition function tomorrow as an example. But of course, in general, you cannot calculate what a partition function is. It's quite complicated to really do that trace of e to minus beta h. But yeah, you can try, and maybe once you have it, it gives you everything there is to know. Questions? So as I said, I use just the canonical ensemble as an example. You can do other ensembles, and I give you a table in the study text of the most commonly used ensembles, which is the grand canonical one. Is the canonical one, grand canonical one, where you allow to change the number of particles. So for the grand canonical ensemble, grand canonical your z will be given by trace e to minus beta h, but you also allow to change the number of particles. So you have to add the corresponding observable is the number of particle operator. And so mu is the chemical potential. And so this is another example of an ensemble, or you can have other examples. But because all of them in thermodynamic limit give you the same thing, usually the canonical ensemble is the simplest one. So let me finish here and continue with an example tomorrow.